This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're celebrating our 20th anniversary as a daily NPR program. Here's how we opened the show 20 years ago. From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Welcome to the premiere of the daily edition of Fresh Air. Each day on Fresh Air, you'll hear from people at the forefront of the arts, entertainment, and contemporary culture. We start our first show with a celebration of Irving Berlin's 99th birthday. Singer Peggy King will be here to perform some of her favorite Berlin songs for us. Also on today's show, exiled Chilean novelist Isabel Allende talks about her second book of Love and Shadows. Music critic Francis Davis says a new recording of Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue lets us finally hear the piece the way Gershwin intended it. And TV critic David Bianculli says goodbye to Hill Street Blues. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Okay, well, in the past 20 years, we changed the theme music, my voice got deeper, I changed how I say Fresh Air. Oh, and I married our former jazz critic, Francis Davis. This month, we've been listening back to some of the interviews we recorded 20 years ago. On this edition, we're asking some of our producers to choose interview moments from the past 20 years that have special significance for them and that they want to play back for us. Most of these sound bites aren't from our most famous or infamous interviews. They're just moments that those of us who work on the show remember fondly. One exchange I'll always remember was when I was interviewing Uta Hagen, the legendary stage actress and revered acting teacher. She wrote two books about the craft of acting, so of course I prepared an interview filled with questions about the craft of acting. But here's what happened. In one of your books about acting, you talk about how you can't be inert on stage, and you have to find out what it is that you actually do while you think you're doing nothing, so that you could do that kind of thing on stage. Have you thought about that a lot, what it is you're doing when you're not really doing anything?
I'm going to interrupt you right now.
Go ahead.
Because, again, everything you're discussing, you have read, it interests you. Are you an actor?
No, I'm not.
Then it's none of your business. Now, let me explain to you why. It may interest you, may fascinate you, but if... you see, I feel that in the theater, everybody thinks they can act. Everybody is fascinated about another human being on stage. If it's very convincing, they usually are sure that they could do it too, which is not true at all. If you would go to a violinist, you would not ask him about his bowing arm, about his elbow position, about his phrasing. And if he told you, you wouldn't know what he's talking about, and you would be bored. These are not the secrets, but the craft itself. You wouldn't ask a scientist because you wouldn't know what he was talking about. And you must, I feel, an audience should learn to respect acting as a craft in the same way that you. If I do explain it, it'll might titillate you. You might understand a little of it, but the real impact or import of it for a fellow artist, you would not get.
I don't
say that to offend you. I just believe that with all my heart.
I want to say I totally respect what you're saying, but I just beg to differ on a couple of things. That for example, I would be asking the violinist about their phrasing and the bend of their arm and all of that.
Why?
Well, because I
think... Do you play violin?
No, but
then I think you might ask him, but I think the violinist would look at you like you were nuts, and I think you are.
No, see, what I have found as someone very interested in these things is that, for instance, if the violinist talks to me about his or her phrasing, it might help me hear music, hear things in music that I didn't hear before. I find that actually understanding more about craft is not only interesting in its own right, but helps me perceive things that I didn't perceive before, which I like.
That's a very valid point. And maybe I'm just in reaction to so many people who ask these questions without and the misunderstanding in of the layman in terms of an acting technique are so profound that I think I've pretty much had it in my life with that. I think that's probably part of my rebellion.
That was the late Uta Hagen, recorded in 1998. In spite of our little disagreement, in part because of it, I love talking with her. When Ira Glass heard that interview, he said it was as if Uta Hagen was trying to single-handedly dismantle the premise of Fresh Air, which is that there's value in hearing performers and writers talk about how they approach their work. We're celebrating Fresh Air's 20th anniversary as a daily national program by listening back to some moments we remember. Our executive producer, Danny Miller, has brought in something to listen to. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Terry. Happy anniversary.
And to you. What did you choose to play for us?
Well, let me preface this by saying that there are a lot of gifted joke tellers in my family. I'm not one of them, but at least I know a really funny piece of tape. And the tape we're going to hear is something I've heard maybe two or three dozen times. It still makes me laugh. It's a clip of an interview with John Lovitz, who was on Fresh Air soon after he left the cast of Saturday Night Live, where he created characters like Annoying Man, Harry Honecker, a bunch of really funny characters. So let me make a connection to the interview that we just heard with Uta Hagen. John Lovitz, when he was growing up, was also really interested in finding out the secrets of acting. But he was able to meet a guy named Ned Glass, who was really all too happy to give him some tips.
When I was 15 years old, I was at my best friend's house, and his father is a doctor, and Ned Glass was one of his patients. Ned Glass, he talks like this, and he was the father on Bridget and Bernie. He was the Jewish father. He's probably the best West Side Story. He was Pops, who I guess who runs the drugstore, the candy store.
Mm-hmm.
When I was 15 years old...
What's wrong with you kids?
Well, when I was... You know, if you see these movies, you know who he is. And my friend's father says to Ned Glass, John wants to be an actor. And he says, you want to be an actor? He goes, what would you do if you hurt your toe? And I said, I'd say, ouch. He goes, would you say ouch if you were Hercules? And he goes, you know what you have to know to be an actor? You have to know everything. You think you could know everything? You have to know everything, you know. So as if he knew everything. And then he goes, you know, there was only... He was the same in everything he played. And he was, you know, he was a good actor and he was funny, but he was always... He was just himself. He was exactly the same. And he says, you know, there was only two actors who were never typecast. Me and Paul Muni. Anyways, I never forgot him, so I... That's why.
That's
and he was good. He was a funny actor, you know. He's funny, but I guess he always thought he played all these different characters, and really he was just always, hello, how are you? I mean, in Julius Caesar, in the movie with Marlon Brando, he's in the opening market scene, and everyone's going, my lord, come here and hither. And he's in the market saying, you want to buy some oranges, my lord? You know.
That was John Lovitz, recorded in 1992. That always makes me laugh, but... You know, I think Ned Glass actually had a good point about Hercules not saying ouch. We're celebrating Fresh Air's 20th anniversary as a daily national program by listening back to some of the moments we remember fondly. I particularly enjoy doing what I've come to think of as the singing autobiography, in which I have a guest musician in the studio, and we alternate between interview and performance. I did that with Dion, who's so much more interesting than the oldies act some people assume he is. He told us the stories behind some of his own songs, like The Wanderer, but he also talked about his influences. Our associate producer and researcher, Sam Brigger, chose an excerpt of this tape. Hey, Sam.
Hey, Terry.
Why'd you choose this?
Well, I first heard this interview as a listener before working on the show, and it's a great example of how you can learn a lot about a musician by looking in their ears, by knowing what it is they listen to. I knew who Dion was before the interview, and I liked his music, but I hadn't really thought much about him. But you get him talking about one of his influences, Hank Williams, someone I really love. And the way Dion describes how Hank Williams sings, about him chewing the ends off his words, was so insightful that I appreciate them both so much more. Plus, he sings a little Hank Williams and he really nails it.
Well, thanks for bringing this in, Sam. And I should mention, Sam's a musician in addition to his work as a radio producer. And here's Dion. Let me go back to the beginning with you, when you were first listening to music. You wrote in your autobiography that Hank Williams really influenced you early on. When you were a kid, growing up in the Bronx, what did you hear in Hank Williams?
Well, Hank Williams seemed like so total to me, so committed to the lyric. He would actually rip the ends of the words off at the, you know, the end of the sentence. It sounded like he'd bite into the word and rip it off. You know, he would do like, well, I can't sing like him, but the kind of idea, like the first song I heard him do was like, and I left my home down on the rural route, told my
Pa was gonna step him down and get the honky-tonk blues. Yeah, the honky-tonk blues. Well, Lord, I got the honky-tonk blues. You know, he said, I'd stop into every place in town. And he'd rip the word right off like, I got it, and there it goes.
That was Dion, recorded in 2000. A record producer heard Dion on Fresh Air, liked what he heard, and asked Dion to record an album of blues and country songs, which he did. It was called Bronx and Blue and was released in 2005. In 2000, our producer Phyllis Myers came to me with a new collection of stories that she liked by a writer she wanted me to interview. His name was F.X. Toole. He was 70, and this was his first book. The stories were based on his experiences working as a cut man, the person who stops a boxer's bleeding between rounds so he can get back in the ring. Well, you never know who's listening. Phyllis, who is listening to F.X. Toole on our show?
Well, when the movie Million Dollar Baby came out, we read that screenwriter Paul Haggis had bought the rights to Toole's book after he heard F.X. interviewed on NPR in September of 2000. Well, we had him on that month. So we decided to contact Haggis to confirm that he heard him on our show. I emailed him. And he wrote back that he listened to the show all the time. And he'd been telling everyone he remembered hearing FX on Fresh Air. And you and I got so excited because we liked FX Toole so much. And we loved the movie.
We sure did. So why don't we hear FX Toole reading from his story, Rope Burns.
I stop blood. I stop it between rounds for fighters so they can stay in the fight. Blood ruins some boys. It was that way with Sonny Liston, God rest his soul. Bad as he was, he'd see his own blood and fall apart. I'm not the one who decides when to stop the fight, and I don't stitch up cuts once the fight's over, and it's not my job to hospitalize a boy for brain damage. My job is to stop blood so the fighter can see enough to keep on fighting. I do that, maybe I save a boy's title. I do that one thing, and I'm worth every cent they pay me. I stop the blood and save the fight. The boy loves me more than he loves his daddy. But you can't always stop it. Fight guys know this. If the cut's too deep or wide, or maybe you've got a severed vein down in there, the blood keeps coming. Sometimes it takes two or three rounds to stop the blood, maybe more. The boy's heart is pumping so hard, or he cuts more. Once you get the coagulant in there, sometimes it takes another shot from the opponent right on the cut itself to drive the blood far enough from the area so the stuff you're using can start to work. What I'm saying is there are all kinds of combinations you come up against down in the different layers of meat. When a good cut man stays ahead of the combinations, he can stop most cuts, but not every one.
Fresh Air is celebrating its 20th anniversary today. As we sat down to look back on the last 20 years at Fresh Air, we found many of the moments we remembered best weren't with our most widely known guests. Many times we found ourselves thinking about people doing great work that we admire, like Father Greg Boyle. He's a Jesuit priest who works with gangs in L.A. He founded Homeboy Industries. Its purpose is to find jobs for ex-gang members. Our producer, Monique Nazareth, wanted to play an excerpt of Father Boyle's interview for us. Monique, why did you want to choose this excerpt?
Well, I thought that this was a great example of one of these people that isn't on everybody else's radar screen. This is somebody who's not out there getting a lot of publicity, but he's doing great work. He's working with these kids. These kids would otherwise be on the streets, probably killing each other, but instead he's got these guys from rival gang members working together side by side. And as you'll hear in this story, sometimes those relationships go beyond work into their personal lives.
Great. Well, let's hear Father Boyle, and thanks, Monique.
A homie who works for me named Robert called me on New Year's Day, and he said, Happy New Year's, and I thanked him. 20 years old, completely rejected by his family, had been living on his own in a crummy apartment, just barely making it. And I said, you know, I was thinking of you, how was your Christmas? Because this is during Christmas. What'd you do Christmas? And he goes, oh, it was just right here in my apartment. I said, by yourself? He said, no, I invited a couple of the homies that I work with who didn't have a place to go either, and these were enemies. I said, really? What'd you do? He goes, you're not going to believe it. I cooked a turkey. I said, really? You cooked a turkey? He goes, yeah. I said, well, how'd you prepare it? He goes, ghetto style. I said, well, I'm not familiar with that recipe. What's ghetto style? And he said, well, I rubbed it with butter, and I poured a gang of salt and pepper on it, Then I squeezed two limones with two lemons all over it. I popped it in the oven. It tasted proper, he said, which is a very gang expression. It tasted proper. And I said, wow, what else did you have besides turkey? And he said, that's it, just turkey. I said, really? He goes, yeah, the six of us just sat in the kitchen staring at the oven waiting for that turkey to be done. And I thought, for me, that's what it's about. It's about six vatos, you know, six gang members, enemies, no place to go, sitting in a kitchen staring at an oven waiting for the turkey to be done. That's as sacred and as ordinary as the Last Supper, you know. That's an example of its of people hanging on to each other and declaring with unshakable certainty that we belong to each other.
Did you suggest a side dish for the next time?
I said sometimes
some
people,
potatoes to
sometimes,
go along with it.
Sometimes your guests actually expect more than just the bird. So.
Yeah.
But, you know, next year we may have something else. I'll try to expand his menu.
Yeah, that's a great story. That was Father Greg Boyle, recorded in 2004, one of the several times we've had him on our show. This is our 20th anniversary show, and we're celebrating by having our producers come in and play for us excerpts of programs that they found particularly memorable. And our producer, Amy Salad, has chosen a tape that's kind of like particularly special to us. Amy, you want to tell the story?
Well, when I was 12, I was a crazy Beatlemaniac. And on the album Introducing the Beatles, there was a song called Anna. And this was something, it wasn't written by the Beatles, it was by Arthur Alexander. I didn't know anything about Arthur Alexander, but then 30 years later, in 1993, he resurfaced. It turns out that he had spent decades struggling with depression, drugs, and alcohol, and had never really received royalties from his music. The Beatles recorded his song, and so did the Rolling Stones. So music producer Danny Kahn found Arthur in 1993. He was driving a bus in Ohio. Danny brought him into a recording studio for the first time in 20 years, and they made an album.
And just about the time the album was coming out, we were in the process of putting together this live program from the annual public radio conference. And Amy, you suggested, why don't we ask Arthur Alexander to perform live on the show? So you actually booked him to perform on the show.
And we got a band. It was in front of a live audience. And there was such a feeling that day of redemption that this artist might finally get the recognition that he had missed out on. So we did the performance, and then a month later, Arthur died. It turned out that he had kidney disease. He had hidden this even from his family. And he collapsed on the floor of his manager's office in Nashville just moments after he had signed a new publishing deal that was finally going to get him his royalties. So this live recording became all the more precious. So this is Arthur Alexander from our 1993 concert.
There was a little girl I had planned to marry. This was my love, I didn't want to share it. I thought that love would make my life bright and sunny. She said she couldn't love me cause I didn't have no money. So every day I have to cry some. Every day I have to cry some. Dry the water from my eyes some. Every day I have to cry. I had me a girl, and yes, I really loved her. Every night, well, I was thinking of her. But you can't mix love with money, cause if you do, you're gonna hurt somebody. And every day I have to cry some. Every day I have to cry some. Dry the water from my eyes some. Every day I have to cry. Lord, I know that I'm just a poor man, but is it wrong to love cause I'm not a rich man? But you can't mix love with money, cause when you do, you're gonna hurt somebody.
Every day I have to cry some. Every day I have to cry some. Dry the water from my eyes some. Every day I have to cry. Every day I have to ooh, cry some. Every day I have to cry some. Travel water from my eyes some. Every day I have to cry. Every day I have to let the water fall from my. Every day I have to let the water fall from my. Every day I have to ooh, cry some. Every day I have to cry some. Travel water from my eyes some. Every day I have to cry.
Thank you. Thank you.
Arthur Alexander in a live Fresh Air concert from 1993. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We can hardly believe it ourselves, but somehow Fresh Air has just reached its 20th anniversary as a daily national show. We were a daily local program in Philadelphia for about 12 years before that. Anyways, to celebrate, our producers have picked some moments from the past 20 years that they remember and that they want to play back for you. 20 years ago, we expected we'd devote most of our time on the show to talking about popular culture. Well, wars and terrorism kind of changed our plans. As we sit safely in our offices and studio, we often talk to war correspondents who have been risking their lives. During the years that Dexter Filkins covered Iraq for the New York Times, he talked to us several times about what was going on there. Here's an excerpt of our interview about being embedded with a Marine battalion during the Battle of Fallujah.
You write about one of the sergeants, Sergeant Wells, who was killed in Fallujah. And it sounds from your writing that the men really admired him a lot. How was he killed?
He was killed on the first morning of the battle. It was about 7 a.m. The fighting had been going on at that point for 11 hours. We had been under fire. The sun was up. The first objective of the unit was to take a mosque. We came under fire, extraordinary fire, from two directions. As soon as we got close to the mosque, the insurgents opened up, and then the Marines opened up, and it was this incredible gun battle that it just went on and on and on. Couldn't hear, couldn't see. Right in the middle of this, one of the lieutenants, or Captain Omohundro, gave the order to take the mosque, and one of the platoons, of which Sergeant Wells was a member, I think it was the second platoon, ran across the street, into the street towards the mosque. They ran right into interlocking machine gun fire, and I think 40 guys ran across that road, and by the time that platoon got to the other side of the road, there were five Marines lying in the road. One of them was Sergeant Wells. The amazing thing, and this happened time again almost every day, was Marines would go down wounded, shot, or dead in just really a storm of gunfire, and other Marines would turn and run into the fire to get their buddies out. And Sergeant Wells was still alive. He'd been hit in the leg. He was bleeding profusely. And one guy after another ran into the road to pull him out. They didn't get Sergeant Wells out in time, and he bled to death shortly afterwards. The other four that got out. He was a senior. Sergeant Wells was a kind of senior guy in the platoon, which I think meant that he was about 27 or something. But he had kind of taken a bunch of the younger guys under his wing, and he'd written letters to their parents saying, "Look, we're going to go into battle, and I'm going to look after these guys, and they're all good kids, and you don't have anything to worry about." And so everybody was really close to him, and were pretty shaken when he died.
That was Dexter Filkins of the New York Times in 2004. In celebration of Fresh Air's 20th anniversary, we've asked our producers to choose interview moments that have stuck in their minds that they'd like to play back for us. Anne-Marie Baldonado produces our movie and TV-related interviews, and those guests are sometimes particularly hard to get. We're huge fans of Sacha Baron Cohen, but it was very difficult to get him on our show. Anne-Marie, why was it so hard?
Well, last fall when the Borat movie came out, Sacha Baron Cohen was only doing interviews as the character Borat, and that's just something you don't do on the show. There are a couple of exceptions to that, though. For example, that great interview you did with Triumph, the insult comic dog. You interviewed him in character, but you also interviewed his creator, Robert Smigel, right afterwards. So you don't really do that if you can't get behind the character. So earlier this year, we were really, really lucky when Sacha Baron Cohen chose to do an interview, a full interview as himself. Here's a little bit of it.
Thanks, Emery. One of the things I love about Borat is that, you know, he's such a funny character. He makes kind of sex in the human body so unappetizing.
Thank you. I take that as a compliment.
Like the costumes
that is actually my body.
No, I know.
I have to say Borat's body and my body.
It's the clothing, though. It's the clothing.
Thank you. The mesh underwear.
That jockstrap bikini that
yeah.
that wraps around his... That's supported by a strap that goes around his neck.
Yeah, well, I must say, actually, that Borat's underwear and is actually provided by my father. That was my dad's underpants.
Seriously?
Yeah, those are my dad's underpants, which are actually made by the Norwegian Navy. There was one occasion where I actually lost my underpants as Borat. I was doing a scene, which actually didn't make it into the movie, where Borat, strapped for cash, starts work as a door-to-door salesman. And he goes into one house, and he's trying to sell them, you know, subscriptions to the local newspaper. And while he's there, by the way, you know, he hasn't washed, he's very poor. He goes, you know, can I use a bathroom, please? And Borat emerges about 5 minutes later, naked, apart from he's wrapped in a towel, which is their towel, and he's holding one of their toothbrushes and going, which toothpaste can I use? At which point I was thrown out of the house by this family. They called the police, and so I'm standing outside in a towel which does not belong to me, and I can hear police sirens getting closer and closer. And I'm looking to the director going, what do I do? Because, and I was thinking in my mind. I'm still in character. And I'm thinking my costume is in the bathroom of this, you know, of this house. I'm standing in a towel that does not belong to me. Now, if I run into the van and, you know, we make a getaway before the police come, it means that I'm actually stealing some property so I can be done for theft. However, if I take the towel off, I can be done for indecent exposure. So I was in this terrible dilemma. What do I do? And the, you know, sirens were getting louder and louder. And in the end, I just ran into the van and, you know, I hid underneath the seat and got on the phone to my lawyer. still, by the way, in character going, hello, what do I do? I do not want to be done for indecent exposure. Do I throw out the towel? Do I throw the towel out? And finally, I was taken to a safe location, and we negotiated to get the costume back and the underpants.
Why did you have to talk to your lawyer at that point in persona?
Why did I have to be in persona? I don't know. Basically, during the days, I stay as Borat, because I never knew if it was something that we could use for the actual movie.
That was Sacha Baron Cohen, recorded earlier this year. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. She's found some really interesting guests over the years, and she's going to tell us about one of them, Eric Davis. When we spoke in 1995, Davis was working as an undercover cop in Cabrini Green, which is a housing project in Chicago that was ruled by gangs. But he was also in a rap group called the Slick Boys with two other undercover cops. Dorothy, what do you remember about this interview?
After the interview was over and the phones began to light up and people were starting to call in from all over asking for the Slick Boys to come to their communities, I realized I wanted them to come to my community as well. So I asked them to come to some organizations in Philly, and they did. And the children were really responsive. They were really impressed that cops would take the time to learned to rap to communicate with them. And I feel good about that. I feel like I did some good in my community, and I supported the Slick Boys for their efforts.
Well, thanks, Dorothy. Here's the excerpt of the interview with Eric Davis.
You got shot twice.
Yes.
What happened?
I was in a movie theater, and I disrespected another young man by telling his girlfriend to take her little brother home so I could go out with her. And I knew he was a gang member. He knew I was a gang member. Started talking garbage because I thought that's what my buddies wanted to hear, and I thought it would be something cute to say. The young lady went in her purse and handed the young man a handgun. He shot me once in the stomach. I turned to run, shot me in the leg. I laid there and thought I was going to die because I've watched so many movies. I thought when you get shot, that, of course, is what happens. You die. My mom was and is one of those old Southern women that always stand on you. Do this boy, do that boy. Don't you get in trouble. Stay away from them. Stay off that corner. And I remember the first thing I said once I was laying on the ground. I said, damn, my mother's going to kill me. Because she's a good mom. And I knew if those bullets didn't kill me, her mouth would definitely kill me. So that was the scenario on how I got shot.
How'd you get to the hospital?
I ran home.
You ran home, shot in the leg and shot in the stomach?
And I got up to run because the guy shooting at me was still coming at me and was going to finish me off. And I ran to my mother and father. They took me to the hospital.
But how did you get away from him when you were wounded like that?
I was running for my life. And I think only people that are shot or have been shot at can relate what that feels like. I thought I was going to die. But I knew if I laid there, he was going to kill me. So I ran. My parents took me to the hospital. While I was in the hospital, the thing that changed me was my mother sitting at the foot of the bed saying, Lord, please, don't let him die. Let me die. And I said, no, Lord, let me die. Please don't let her die. Because there won't be anybody to take care of my brothers and sisters. And right then, I realized I'm already in a gang. And this gang is the gang that really cares about me. My buddies I was with, none of them are here at my bed crying. But my sisters and my mom were there crying. My dad was there crying. And that's when I made the decision that I was going to go and change my life around, no matter what.
That was Eric Davis, recorded in 1995. In celebration of Fresh Air's 20th anniversary, we've asked our producers to choose some of the moments they remember fondly from the past 20 years. Our producer, Amy Salad, is back with another interview moment she wants to play for us. What have you chosen this time, Amy?
This is an interview. It's from 12 years ago, and it's with Tenzin Shogyal. He's the brother of the Dalai Lama. And I love this moment because here's a guy whose brother is referred to as His Holiness. And Tenzin Shogyal himself is a reincarnate lama. Yet, Terry, you come up with a question that reminds us that no matter how rarefied the world is that he inhabits, he's still a human being and he's subject to the same kinds of messy emotions as the rest of us.
How old were you when your brother was chosen?
I wasn't born.
Uh-huh.
I'm the youngest.
So when you grew up, you knew all along that your brother was being groomed to be the spiritual and political leader of his people.
Right. That is 12 years difference between His Holiness and me.
Do you know the concept of sibling rivalry?
Yes, I know. I know very well. Yes.
I mean, were you ever jealous of your brother? Or was it just so phenomenally different?
No, His Holiness always teases me, saying that I had more time to be breastfed than he himself. So therefore, he's a little jealous, I suppose.
That was the Dalai Lama's brother. It's our 20th anniversary, and some of our producers have selected moments from the past 20 years that they remember fondly and want to play back for you. Our director, Roberta Sherrock, chose the next one. It features the writer Robert Sullivan. Roberta, tell us the story of how you found Robert Sullivan before he had even published his first book.
Well, I was on a plane about 10 years ago going to Seattle. And when I'm on a plane for that length of time, I tend to not talk to the people next to me because I don't want to get into a six-hour conversation. And also, I don't want them to find out I work for Fresh Air because then they start pitching ideas or there's that they get really excited and they take a big, you work for Fresh Air. So I didn't say anything to this young man who was sitting next to me who was reading and writing most of the way. But when the plane was landing, I said something to him and he told me that he was coming back from Ireland where he was working on a magazine assignment. And then he asked me what I did, and I said I worked for public radio and in Philadelphia. And then he said, Fresh Air, and I said, yeah. Then he told me he was writing his first book. And about 6 months later, he sent it to us. It was called The Meadowlands, and we loved it. And we've had him on for every book since.
I want to stress that pitching yourself to a Fresh Air producer who's seatbelted to the chair next to you is not the most effective way of getting on the show. but we were glad, Roberta, that you met Robert Sullivan on the plane. Anyways, the last time we had Sullivan on, he'd written a book about his many cross-country trips with his wife and two children by car. And he surprised me by showing up for the interview with his two children. I had not planned to talk with him for the interview, but there they were. So I figured, well, you know, be interesting to hear what they say have to say about being in the back seat for these long trips. But then I had another surprise, which I didn't see coming because they were in a studio in New York and I was in a studio in Philadelphia. Here's what happened. Do you as a family ever revert to singing songs together on the road to keep occupied and entertained?
Oftentimes, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah? Yeah. What are the songs of preference?
Trad.
Yes, trad. Or folk. But I didn't know what trad meant until this year, so.
So what does it mean?
Well, it's an abbreviation for traditional, so. Yeah,
so are you doing traditional folk music or traditional jazz?
Mostly traditional, both, but mostly traditional folk. I mean, yeah.
Should I ask for a rousing version of a car favorite, a cross-country car favorite?
Can we do it?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, Carrie, is it okay?
Please.
Okay. How's this?
Do you actually have a guitar with you?
Yes, we have all our instruments. Well, not all of them, but...
Did you know it's National Accordion Awareness Month?
Dad just got an accordion that he's very excited about, so... Tempted and tired, we're off made to wonder why it should be.
Wow, who knew you'd sound so good? I was thinking
you.
More of my family. You guys are good. That was writer Robert Sullivan and his children, Sam and Louise. We're celebrating Fresh Air's 20th anniversary as a daily national program by listening back to some moments from the past 20 years. Some guests have been on our show so many times, we've started to think of them as part of the Fresh Air family. That's certainly how we felt about Susanna McCorkle, who was one of my favorite jazz singers. Over the years, I got to know her a little bit outside the show, but not well enough to have realized the problem she had with depression. I was shocked when she took her life in May 2001. It means a lot to us that we have the recording she made on our show. Her first Fresh Air performance was on July 17, 1987. It was the day of our 50th broadcast, and when the broadcast was over, we all celebrated with champagne. On that program, she sang a perfect version of a song from The Wizard of Oz.
An empty kettle, she should be on her mettle, and yet I'm torn apart. Just because I'm presuming that I could be kinda human if I only had a heart. I'd be tender, I'd be gentle, an awful sentimental regarding love and art. I'd be friends with the sparrows and the boy that shoots the arrows if I only had a heart. Picture me a balcony above, a voice sings low. Wherefore art thou, Romeo? I hear a beat. How sweet, just to register emotion, jealousy, devotion, and really feel the part. I would stay young and chipper, and I'd lock it with a zipper if I only had a heart. If I only had a heart.
That was the late Susanna McCorkle, recorded in 1987. As we come to the end of this 20th anniversary broadcast, I'm thinking of the way our interviews typically end. I say, thank you so much for talking with us. And our guests say, thank you, Terry, or great to be here. But interviews don't always end that predictably, as we're about to hear, starting with Bill O'Reilly, then Triumph the Insult Comic Dog.
And if you think that's fair, Terry, then you need to get in another business. And that is the end of this interview.
If you think it's fair, Terry, you need to get into another business.
Well, Ray Charles, it has been so wonderful to talk with you. I really thank you so much for your time.
Well, Terry, it's been good talking to you, and I just want you to know not only is it good to talk to you, but I'm going to keep on listening to you, too.
I would like to think that the personality you've presented on our show today is a persona that you've affected as a member of KISS, something that you do on stage and before the microphone, but that you're not nearly as obnoxious in the privacy of your own home or when you're having dinner with friends.
Fair enough. And I'd like to think that the boring lady who's talking to me now is a lot sexier and more interesting than the one who's doing NPR, you know, studious and reserved. And I bet you're a lot of fun at a party.
Well, we'll leave it at that. Gene Simmons,
Sure. Thanks
so much.
I look forward to our meeting.
Bye-bye. Well, Artie, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks. I hope this was all right. I feel like it really does feel like a shrink session.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
No, it's good. This
so
was,
you're going to go into therapy now?
Maybe. Maybe I'll just keep coming here every day. We could do this.
Can you say that thing?
Say what thing?
Say what you say, you know.
Thanks so much for talking with us?
No. About your show.
Oh, you mean the Fresh Air thing?
Yeah.
You really want me to say that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. For you, sure. From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Is that what you meant?
That's exactly what I meant. Thanks.
That was Danny DeVito. Before that, we heard Artie Lang from The Howard Stern Show. Moving on, here's Lou Reed.
This isn't working, okay? Thanks a lot. I'll see you.
Okay.
Larry Flint, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, look, I want to tell you, you really did a terrific job on those questions about the genitalia. The guys don't know how to deal with that.
Oh, well, good. Well, thank you. Johnny Cash, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
I want to say you're really good at what you do, and I appreciate you.
I want to thank you so
much.
Does
that answer your question?
Yes.
I'm sorry. I interrupted your trademark. Thank you so much. I look forward to so much. I was trying to prepare what I would say to you. I enjoyed so much, and I thought, well, me too, or so much. It was my pleasure. I had a whole list of them, and now they're all gone. So let's just improv this.
Okay, let's just try it. Stephen Colbert, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
That collection of thank yous was put together by our producer, Ian Chillog. Thanks, Ian. And the thank yous aren't over yet. I want to thank you for listening, which is the only reason why we're on the air. And of course, I want to thank the Fresh Air staff. Here they are.
Jonathan Menjivar, 1 year. Sam Brigger, 2 years.
Ian Chillog, 5 years.
Patty Leswing, 8 years.
Anne-Marie Baldonado, 9 years.
Monique Nazareth, 10 years.
Dorothy Farabee, 17 years.
Roberta Shorrock, almost 18 years.
Phyllis Myers, 20 years.
Amy Sallet, 22 years.
Danny Miller, 28 years.
I also want to thank everyone else who has helped produce Fresh Air over the years. Our alumni, Naomi Person, Chris Spurgeon, Ed Doherty, Lisa Bruton, Joan Tui Westman, Alan Tu, Megan Howell, and Jessica Chu. Our guest hosts, David Bianculli, Dave Davies, Barbara Bogave, and Marty Muscoane. Sue Spolin and the rest of our freelance staff who help us out so we can take some time off every once in a while. Our engineering and technical staff, Audrey Bentham, Bob Purdick, Joyce Lieberman, and Julian Hertzfeld. And the rest of our colleagues at NPR and WHYY in Philadelphia. Sending us off is music from Don Byron's 1997 Fresh Air concert. At 31 years and counting, I'm Terry Gross.